If you're a mom or dad or aging, I can tell you, my heart goes out to you. I've been there multiple times. If you have these older relatives, there's a whole host of issues, and nothing is so intense or highly charged as what to do about mom and dad. Well, this week's guest has not only personal experience in this, she has professional experience in it. And the professional always gets personal when it's your family. And she has so much wisdom, and she can take so much of your anxiety away if you'll just listen to her. Jennifer Sakai.
You know, but every time I had a child, it was like, what in the world did I think? How did I think I was going to do both?
This is In Her Words, a podcast from manlisting.com, featuring one man listening to the stories of real women in their own words. In Her Words, a conversation worth hearing, because every woman deserves to be heard.
Hey there, hi there, and welcome to In Her Words, the podcast, where we're getting close to trademarking the phrase, her story's important. And Jennifer Sakai's story is very important because it's so relatable and it's so relevant to so many of us who have aging parents or are aging ourselves. I'm now becoming the problem adult. The problem parent for my kids. I always wanted to live to this age where I was somebody else's problem again. So you will hear a lot of empathy, a lot of compassion, and a lot of just plain old kindness from my guest, Jennifer Sakai. Where were you born?
I was born in Charlotte.
Hospital or home?
Hospital, Presby, Maine.
Wonderful.
Yep.
For your mother, you're number what of how many?
One of two.
And how much younger?
Three years.
Sister?
Sister, yes.
Mm-hmm. And is she around here?
She's in Hendersonville.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So y'all still stay in touch?
Yeah, mom's in Asheville, which is where I grew up. So, yeah.
That's wonderful. So. Is your dad still with us?
Nope. No, he passed away when he was 64. Yeah.
Oh, my word. Yep. How did he die?
Prostate cancer. It's interesting because it's one of those, learning a lot through his cancer journey, it's one of those that's can be very deceptive. You can have somebody that has, you know, prostate cancer that it remains very low. Their PSA never really moves, and it's something that they just live with. And then you can have people that have very aggressive, forms of prostate cancer that are moving a lot more quickly.
I'm always struck by what people do for a living. It could be a nonprofit, it could be a church group, it could be like a ministry, it could be for profit, it could be governmental work, it could be just volunteer work. I gather, is your business a for-profit or a non-profit?
It's for-profit.
It nonetheless is a social good.
Yes.
I mean, you could be doing the exact same thing for a church.
Right.
Or a non-profit group.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something about service, even ministry, that you were raised in, like the notion of respecting your elders?
I think the concept of service is something that I can reflect back to my childhood and really see. And I think what some people miss when they make the distinction of kind of what category of employment they have is that you really do have the ability to be a servant leader or see yourself as somebody that's in service to others in whatever kind of job you have. And I think my dad definitely modeled that. I don't have tangible examples when he was a sales rep, which was what he did, you know, up until I was in really late high school. But his last career change after he did the church fundraising was as a financial advisor. And I feel like he often would make decisions that he knew were in the best interest of the client, but didn't necessarily, you know, serve him. So, you know, maybe if there was commission involved, for example, I think a lot of people, you know, assume that, well, like if you're based on commission, you have some commission job, you're always going to do what creates money. And he was the exception to that. And witnessing that was just kind of a reminder that you can have a job that's profitable and be in a for-profit world, but still do the right thing. And I think doing the right thing was always something that was kind of front and center. And there were times, you know, privately where we would see that he would do the right thing in a circumstance and it wouldn't be to his benefit. And, you know, sometimes to the detriment of his position or what have you. And so watching him do that and hold steadfast to doing what's right, even when it doesn't benefit you, is something that really, really sunk in. And I don't think I necessarily realized that as I was getting started, but in thinking back and in listening to people talk and give me feedback about, you know, oh, what you do is so rewarding and it's so, you know, you're helping everyone. When people describe what I do or give feedback about what we do or what kind of impact we've had, I stop and realize that, you know, I have gotten to a point, hopefully, you know, where I'm kind of like him, where I've been able to emulate this notion that, you know, we need to do the right thing. And so that's what I tell my team. We need to do the right thing by the client all the time. And so even if that's harder work for us, or even if that puts us in a situation where we're having uncomfortable conversations with family, or we're having to kind of stick our neck out on the line, we're always going to do what's in the best interest of the client. And I think that kind of attitude you can really have in a lot of jobs, you know, looking out for the other person. And it was interesting because when we had his funeral, instead of doing like a wake or something, you know, just a plain kind of visitation at the funeral home, we actually kind of opened it up for people to, at the funeral home, for people to tell stories. And one of the things that was very striking, there were a few stories that I didn't know as his daughter, you know, probably happened at times in his life that wouldn't have been appropriate for us to know, you know, that something was going on. And, you know,
tell me one of those.
Yeah. So one of them was that the church had a new music director, and it was someone that my parents really liked. And but because he was a church music director, you know, he was working like three jobs to kind of make ends meet. And my dad apparently handed him a credit card and said, put whatever you need to on this, you know, food, gas. And so when he stood up and told that story, I think just the realization in the room that he had so generously, you know, extended help and didn't, you know, tell anybody. You know, my mom was aware, obviously, but I don't think anybody else knew that that was something that he had done. And, you know, for that, I know that that person always felt appreciative and always felt tremendous gratitude towards my parents. And so that put that in context after hearing that story. But, you know, there was never this, you know, let's write a newspaper article about it so that everyone finds out what he did. Or, you know, there's never a draw to, like, for my dad to feel like other people needed to know about it. It was just something that he did. And again, it was the right thing to do. And they were in a place where they could be generous and help others. And that was kind of the attitude that he always had. But hearing people tell stories like that, it was very striking, and very striking for his siblings. We had many, many people in his family tell us afterwards that they were just really moved by hearing about different parts. You know, because I think particularly as siblings, when you get older, you just kind of have that relationship. You know, whatever relationship you have with your sibling is kind of the relationship that you have. And so it kind of becomes one-dimensional. And so for them to see other parts of him, I think was really, you know, eye-opening for them. My dad was a very spiritual person. He was a theology major and taught, he actually taught at Charlotte Catholic, and, you know, grew up we had a...
There's a special place in heaven for people who teach.
Yes.
Especially teenagers.
Yes, exactly. So it was interesting kind of watching his faith journey and then just, you know, just the complications of being a member of the Catholic Church. And I'm a very liberal person, so that presents a lot of challenges with many religions, but definitely with Catholicism. So,
especially in Charlotte. Now, if you go someplace else, right. Go to San Francisco.
Right, exactly. I don't go to church regularly, but I still do consider myself, you know, a very spiritual person. So if my mom says, you know, oh, I've got folks at church praying for you, you know, that's not a bad thing. I'm not at all.
You don't.
That's
bite
a wonderful
her head
thing,
off.
Right? Yeah, that's a wonderful thing. You know, and I do pray for other people. I mean, and again, it's not a rote prayer. It's more of, gosh, I'm so worried. It's having a conversation out loud and thinking through. I'm worried for this person, and I really hope that things go well, or that they get a good test result, or whatever the situation is for them. So, you know, does it work? I don't know, but it makes me feel better. And again, I think that's part of what faith is for, is making us feel better. So it doesn't really matter if it works or not in the end. It
needs to work for you.
Yes. Yep.
Otherwise, it's just masochism.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, it's just pointless.
Right.
Life's short. Don't make yourself suffer.
Right.
This should be a balm.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get to founding your business?
In high school, I started volunteering at a continuing care retirement community. So that's a place that's got all of the levels of care. There was one two neighborhoods over from my neighborhood, and this was back when you could ride the school bus and tell the bus driver where to drop you off. And so every Monday, I would have her drop me off at the entrance of this community, and I would walk, and they would give me the names of two or three people that were interested in having a friendly visitor. And that's exactly what I was. And so it was my job to knock on their doors and simply say hello and then engage in conversation with them. And so I think about, like, it's interesting as I've had, you know, different roles that are kind of more towards like sales and marketing. I don't know why I was so opposed to the notion of cold calling, because I feel like to some extent that's what I was doing in high school. I was walking into these people's homes not knowing what we were going to talk about, but there was such a level of comfort with it being an older adult, because I knew it was going to be something that was interesting. I knew that they were going to have stories to tell. And somehow I knew that I could kind of pull that out of them. And I look back and think, yeah, I wasn't doing that volunteer time for anything. There was nothing I needed volunteer hours for. I was just doing that because it was something that I enjoyed. So I really feel like that and the relationship that I had with my grandmother were kind of the seeds that were planted for really recognizing that older adults have something, you know, to contribute and have interesting stories to tell. And it's not that I felt like I had close relationships with every older adult in my life. It was just that I had a really good one with my grandmother and was able to kind of find other people where I could replicate having that relationship, you know, and genuinely enjoyed their company. So I kind of feel like I'm an old soul. And so sitting down and talking to somebody who's in their 80s, it's fascinating. I just feel like I learned so much, and I feel very much at home when I'm talking to somebody who's much older. I just feel like there's so much wisdom there, and again, just really fascinating stories. Even if they don't think that they're fascinating, they're really just very interesting life experiences.
Were you cognizant that you might be the only human voice that person might encounter in a day or even a week?
I don't think I realized that until I started making the visits. And then I kind of figured out that I was, in some cases, the only person that they had visited with. And so then I figured out that, you know, okay, there must be a reason why this person is on my list on Mondays, you know, that they're And looking back now, knowing what I know about aging and older adults, I look back and wonder, like, was this person starting to have some dementia and they were kind of self-isolating? And so this was the community's attempt at kind of like sending someone in because they weren't maybe going to the main building to do activities any longer, because that was hard to, you know, keep up with all of those steps and all of the executive functioning that goes into that. So it does make me curious to know how they picked the people, but yeah, I definitely got the sense. I mean, and my grandmother would always say, you know, oh, I always like, you know, when you come and visit or when you come and talk to me, because, you know, it was kind of like, well, what else am I doing with my time? You know, I have shows that I would like to watch, and that was about it. So it's, you know, the meals, the shows, and then whoever you were conversing with kind of made up the structure of your day. To some extent, for some older adults. And so realizing that you know, had a part in that, a part in them having more human connection, I felt like was interesting. Even if they weren't, I think the people I visited were always friendly, but, you know, you occasionally encounter people and...
No shotguns, I hope.
No shotguns. I'm pretty sure I had my fair share of cookies, because I'm sure that they probably offered me juice and cookies at every place that I visited. But yeah, it, you know, and then kind of going through grad school and understanding my
under... What'd you study?
So my undergraduate degree was in sociology. And so I can remember when I finally figured out what my degree was going to be in. I mean, I went to Belmont Abbey because I wanted something small. I wanted to be somewhere that nobody would know who I was. And it was a pretty safe bet that no one from my high... Everyone was going to Chapel Hill. And I did not want high school 2.0. So I wanted to go somewhere different. And so, sure enough, nobody else was going to Belmont Abbey. And it was very small. And so, you know, knowing... Like, walking to the cafeteria and... having professors walk by and know your name, or the monks walk by and know your name, was very comforting to me. And so I decided that I was going to stay there, and I picked my major, honestly, because I picked the classes that were of interest to me, and I really loved the two sociology professors who were there, and so I picked sociology. But when I did, everyone was like, so sociology factory? Like, what is this?
What is sociology?
So it's the study of society, essentially. So
how people gather in groups.
Yeah. So the person in society. So it was just very fascinating, because I think a lot of classes explained, it was just so interesting to understand differently what was going on with forming groups, but also just with a person as an individual and how they interact in society. And so I tell people that people watching was never the same after that, because I would people watch with a whole different set of, you know, information about what was going on and why they were doing different things. But I knew I needed to narrow down. I mean, what do you do with a sociology degree? So I knew I needed to keep going. And so UNC Charlotte had a gerontology program, and I did my undergraduate.
Which is the study of?
Study of aging. Yeah. I did, Belmont Abbey requires, or they did at the time, an undergraduate thesis, which is not typical. And so I did it on a new Alzheimer's medication that had come out. And so that's kind of what steered me in that direction when I realized there was a gerontology program. So I went through that, and it was not a medical-based program. It was very psychosocial. And again, just really kind of understanding the person, except that in all of your coursework, the person was an older person. So, you know, an older person and their role in family and how that changes over time, and an older person in society and, you know, different societies and the value of older adults and the perspective of aging. So all of that was just very interesting. I did take I'm going to go ahead and just out myself. I did take some test that they had at Belmont Abbey that was kind of like you answered a bunch of questions and it would print out what your ideal job was. So my ideal job was a funeral director.
Which is a service.
It is. Yeah. To find out as a 20-year-old that you're headed to be a funeral director was not the information I was hoping the computer would spit out for me. But it does, I look back in that and think, well, I think about all the skill sets that are needed for somebody that is a funeral director. And I feel like a lot of those are a part of our job, you know, being really good listeners, being compassionate, empathetic. I mean, a lot of, so I know, I understand why that was the job.
I keep telling my kids I want a Viking funeral. I want
that would
my
be
daughter
amazing.
To fire. There's only one state which allows a Viking funeral. It's Maine.
Oh, I was going to guess Washington State. That is fascinating. Maine. Wow. But
I think what you can do is have your remains cremated,
mm-hmm.
put them on some wooden structure, float it out over a pond or whatever, and then figure out a way for somebody to light it.
Yes.
You know?
That's amazing.
And then your ashes descend into the pond. And if it's on private land.
Right.
Nobody can say anything.
Yeah.
Unless the stream flows elsewhere, but.
Right. That was an amazing scene in the movie, First Night. I loved that. Yeah, the Viking, the send-off where they shot the arrow and.
There's a very funny scene in Game of Thrones where the first guy fires the flaming arrow and he misses the boat and it keeps floating farther downstream. There's an eye roll and then the good archer nails the boat and it bursts into flames. It is very funny. But I digress. It would be very easy for you to go to work for someone else or to go to work for a governmental agency that deals with older people or for some other big business.
Right.
It's a long way from that to becoming an entrepreneur in this space.
Right.
So why form a for-profit company?
Again, I think that kind of goes back to what I watched my dad do. I felt like it was really interesting to watch the process of being your own boss and taking ownership in all parts of the company. Occasionally my dad would have an employee or two, but for the most part it was him. And so the hustle, you know, that I saw that you know, that was just a part of who he was. But I also recognize too, as a child in the household of an entrepreneur, the financial freedom that we had as a result of him having a successful company and being a successful entrepreneur was something that gave me experiences that I would, you know, not have had if my dad had had a cubicle job or a desk job growing up. And so
there's also control.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
You don't have to complain about the boss.
Right.
You can say, I don't think we should do it, and I run the company, so get your own company.
Right, right. And I think a lot of people sometimes make the assumption that, well, if you're an entrepreneur, you don't want to work for anybody else. But again, like, you know, in my dad's situation, I mean, if he wanted to be good at sales, he had to have customers. And so he had to be somebody that could work with others. And so, and I kind of feel the same way. I mean, if I want to have a successful business, I can't be somebody that has the attitude like I'm going to do this my way and I'm not going to listen to what anybody else has to say. I mean, you don't have to be a renegade person to, you know, to be able to own a business. It's just sometimes the other part that's appealing. So, you know, I think when I started the business, I thought mistakenly, I thought, oh, this would be the perfect business to have with, you know, with kids. And so I started the business right before we got married. And, you know, but every time I had a child, it was like, what in the world did I think? How did I think I was going to do both? And so, you know, recognizing that that's obviously a gender difference with dad's experience as an entrepreneur versus my experience as an entrepreneur. And,
yeah, built-in childcare.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, and we were fortunate, you know, my mom was a stay-at-home mom, so we grew up with that. So, yeah, so it's been interesting kind of finding my way as a female entrepreneur. That's not something I really dwell on a lot because I don't necessarily think it's a handicap for us, but I do think it presents some interesting challenges. And that was one of them. I went down the entrepreneur path thinking, I'm going to go into business for myself. I'll be able to set my own schedule. And then, you know, along comes this infant that you know, is going to set my schedule for me. Plus, you know, client, it's also the kind of job where, you know, with client emergencies, you can't always plan for when things are going to come up. So it very quickly became something where I realized I needed to have other team members. But then I also saw it, and I had a business coach that helped me see this, you know, that if I'm out there helping people as one person, if my reach is maybe 20 people max, that's 20 people. But what if I can inspire, train, mentor other people to do this, and everybody is reaching 20 people? And so then seeing it from that perspective was not necessarily, and it never has been, a bottom line thing for me, a money thing. It's always been, how many people can we impact? And so when I meet with my team every January, I don't talk about numbers or hours or anything. It's how many people, how many clients did we serve last year? And how many do we want to try to serve this year? And I think if you're focused on that, it just, the rest falls into place. And you can be profitable, and you can have a good business with that mentality. And I wish a lot of business owners would kind of adopt that and would know that coming in. And so I see my growth as not building an empire or anything like that, grandiose, but that it really is about me, how many people can we reach? And if I can find really good people to bring onto the team, every person that comes on is somebody else that expands our reach and expands the number of people that we're able to help. And so that's really what I passionately believe in.
I have only the fuzziest idea. What do you do? What is your business? What is Caregiving Corner?
Yeah, so we mainly provide care management services. So care management services are really when a professional, very often it's a social worker or nurse, somebody with an advanced degree that focuses on aging, essentially comes into the fold during the caregiving process, and they are going to evaluate the older adult's needs, figure out what's going on with the situation, look at the financial piece, the legal pieces that are in place, what are the challenges related to where the person is living, the family support that they have, the needs that they have. It's a total kind of, you know, top to bottom evaluation of that person's circumstances. And then trying to have the conversation with family and the older adult about what are your goals? What do you want this to look like? And where are the pain points that we need to address to get you there? I mean, you know, a lot of people plan for retirement, but they plan for retirement. They plan to be on cruises. They plan to go on vacations. They plan to rent an RV. Nobody's retirement plan involves, you know, oh, I can't wait till I get to the assisted living, or I can't wait until I'm in a wheelchair, or, you know, so you've entered this phase where it's the part that nobody wants. And so there's a lot of complexity, a lot of emotional baggage that comes with that, rightfully so. That's not an incorrect, you know, response to the situation. But because of that, it makes it very difficult for anybody in the family unit to be able to be objective, to be able to stand back and say, this is what's going on with mom. This is what she needs. This is what's in her best interest. And so we are the professional that comes into the situation with no emotional connection to the client or their family and evaluates and says, this is what mom needs. This is what's in her best interest. And this is how we get from where we are now to where we need to be. And so if the goal is let's keep mom at home for as long as we can, then that becomes our goal that we adopt. And we say, okay, if you want to keep mom at home, this is how we're going to do it. And you need XYZ. And based on your budget, we're going to use this many hours of home care, and we're going to use your insurance to cover this, and we're going to set up this service, and we want to address all of the areas of concern and the areas of risk, because we want that person to be able to meet their goal of staying at home as long as possible. But we've got to do it with some supports in place, and so it's our job to kind of manage that whole process. So, you know, when we're problem solvers, we are fixers, we are counselors, we do a lot of listening, a lot of people just say, I just need somebody to bounce ideas off of or make sure that I'm not losing my mind. You know, we're thinking about going in this direction. Is this crazy? What is this going to do down the road financially to my parents' situation? Those kinds of things. People just need somebody that kind of knows the whole system to be able to look at their situation and say, this is what you need to do, or this is the direction that you need to go.
This is far bigger nightmare than wedding planner.
Yes.
Between the daughter and the mother, because you're talking about someone's agency, their freedom, their whole lives. How do you sit with a parent and child, or this is an even bigger one, two siblings or multiple siblings who are going in different directions and who are screaming at each other or whatever? How do you diffuse? How do you take the temperature down? How do you get to, I love you?
Right.
You know? I love you and I want what's best for you.
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. I think, I think honestly, my presence and demeanor brings the temperature down in a room. And I know that's not something people can see while they're listening to this, but
you can hear your calming influence.
But I do think that that's our, you know, when I tell the team, you know, we don't want to contribute to the energy. We want to diffuse it. And so coming in and listening and just not participating in getting things ratcheted up a few notches automatically kind of brings things down. And recognizing that, you know, I always tell people when you talk to a family, the adult children, you know, and their siblings, they always have concerns. So it's always, I worry that, what if mom doesn't take her medicine? What if dad wanders? What if mom drives and gets lost? What if? And so it's all the what ifs. You talk to the older adult and it's always, I want to keep driving. I want to stay at home. I want to be able to decide when I go somewhere. I want to, you know, but I tell people that the misconception is that those are opposite ends of the spectrum, like opposite, you know, black and white, yes and no. And what I tell people is that it's not, and there's plenty of room for compromise. So hearing from an adult child, I'm concerned about mom's driving. I don't want her to drive. And mom says, I want to continue to drive. Maybe there's room for a compromise that mom decides to only drive during the daytime or only drive a particular loop, you know, to the grocery store. Or she agrees to have a mobile phone that has Life 360 or some tracking device or something, you know, to so that we have more information about what's going on when the person's actually driving and how that's going. So it's giving the older adult what they want, but maybe with enough restrictions in place that the adult child feels better about the situation, because, and I think we do this, you know, as parents too, the tendency is to, no, we don't want this to happen. And so we very quickly react, but then we shut everything down. And so having that conversation, just letting people see the nuance of that, I think is really important. You know, people come in and say, well, we completely disagree about this. And it's like, well, let's talk about that. Do you completely disagree, or do you, you know, so is there room for compromise? So we're always kind of having that bit of it, bit of the conversation. I think though, people have to recognize, particularly when there's been a lot of emotional baggage, that you don't necessarily get back to a place where things are restored or where relationships are intact. I mean, we deal with a lot of clients that are indefinitely estranged from family members because of things that have happened. And sometimes that's just what's in the cards for people. And I tell people that, I tell team members that even if we feel like, oh, we just need to fix this, this person is at the end of their life and we really want them to be reconnected, we don't know. We don't know all of the things that have happened. And so that may not be what's best for either party. And so we just kind of need to let things go. But I think reframing things is part of our job as care managers. So reframing the adult child's worry and concern and knee-jerk reaction and kind of repackaging that so that the older adult understands it's not that she wants you to stop driving. She's not trying to take this right away from you. It's that she's very worried that you're going to end up in Indiana while you went to the grocery store, you know, and so getting them to understand that helps kind of soften everything and open up the room for, you know, for conversation and figuring out how are we going to solve this problem.
What conversations have you had with your mom that you wouldn't have before you became a professional in this field?
I think I've definitely had more conversations with family members, definitely with mom, about kind of the pros and cons of deciding to live at home, you know, versus making the decision to move into a continuing care retirement community or, you know, my mom's independent, so we really haven't talked about assisted living. What's interesting, though, is that the pandemic really changed that. And my mom, who's in our childhood home, you know, is in a neighborhood. And so the neighborhood has kind of ebbed and flowed in terms of the age. And now it's kind of trending back young. And so there's lots of families. And so she thoroughly enjoyed being able to take walks every day during the pandemic and see people. And if she had been in a retirement community, she would not have had that freedom. And so, you know, having conversations and understanding how important that is to her has been really good for me to hear, because I know probably better than I did before the pandemic how critical that was for her and for her well-being. I think I feel like I know we definitely talk about it and think about it more. My husband is a good bit older than I am, and so I find myself thinking through things when I see client situations, kind of like, oh, okay, if I ever found myself in this situation, how would I handle it? And, you know, it's very different when it's your own situation. So I know that I'm going to look at a situation with a parent or a spouse with a very different lens than I do as a professional, but it does make you think about things and make different decisions. I think prior to this job, I would have been somebody that would have said, I do want some part of life support or some part of, and now I don't, I'm not interested at all in being kept alive. You know, so for me personally to put into my documents that I don't want any life extending treatment at all. And I would probably be very aggressive as I get older about not wanting, I would not want CPR. I would not, you know, I do now as somebody in my mid 40s who's relatively healthy. But as I get older, that would be probably one of the first changes that I would make, is no CPR. So, yeah, so little DNR. Tweaks. Yes.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of misunderstanding about DNR.
There is. Yeah.
And there's, oh, you're trying to kill me. And
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And, people do have a lot of misconceptions, and that's also part of our job, is trying to teach people. And the subject of DNR is hard because you don't want to be too graphic about it. But the reality is that, you know, if you've ever been a medical provider and you've done CPR on somebody that never should have had CPR, and the injuries that come along with that and the life altering outcomes, you know, you have to figure out a way to kind of communicate that if you've got a client.
Do you want to spend the last 10 days or 10 months of your life with cracked ribs and a cracked sternum and
exactly punctured lung
and having to, you know, lie there and not be able to heal and
right.
Aches and pains and sharp pains and
yep.
having to get painkillers and bad TV that you can't even control. And
right. Yeah. There's a lot that people have to think through. And then some people are very set and their minds can't be changed about, you know, whatever it is that they've, you know, made their minds up about. And we have to honor that. You know, if we come into a situation where a client is completely adamant at the age of 90 that they are full code, they want CPR, they want every life-saving measure, we can educate them on what that would look like, and we can have the doctor have that conversation with them. But, you know, at the end of the day, if they don't have a DNR, I mean, we have to honor that.
And let's face it, the vast majority of people either don't have the conversation or they don't really know what it looks like.
Right.
And then they change their mind And then it's very hard to undo.
Right.
Because you get into, is this person lucid? What were their, you know,
right,
et cetera. And then you get into legal battles. And I know from personal experience with my mom and dad and with my birth mother that their primary thing is, if anybody raises hell, we don't care if it's a second cousin, we don't want to be sued down the road. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, the person's wishes, if there's not a person to do that, if there's just a document, unless there's a lawyer or a child or something, there's nothing to enforce
exactly
the wishes.
Exactly.
And so they're winging it.
Right. Right.
At the continuing care, whether it's skilled nursing, assisted living, whatever, they're winging it.
Right. Yeah, if you only have a document and that document is not on file with your doctor or the hospital system and you go to the hospital and there's not a person to show up and tell people what that document says or show them that document, they're going to do everything that they can to save you. They're going to put you back together again and then they're going to discharge you back into the long-term care system.
And they're going to put you in an ambulance when you have diarrhea.
Right.
Send you to the emergency room.
Right.
Yeah. I've had that. Yeah. Had that happen. I'm not going to take your whole day. But I am going to ask you, do you want to be buried or cremated?
Cremated.
And where do you want your ashes to go?
Somewhere in the mountains, but location doesn't matter.
Have you told people that?
Yes. Yes.
Like what mountains? There are a lot of mountains in the
yeah.
world.
Well, I don't know. I mean, like I think Asheville, but I wouldn't be sad if it was the Rockies or I just love mountains. So I was thinking about that because we were at the beach this weekend and I was like, I'd be a little annoyed.
You'd be sandy.
If my kids.
There'd be sand in your ashes.
Yeah, there'd be sand in my ashes, exactly. I don't particularly enjoy sand in my toes, so I would be very annoyed if I had sand in my ashes. So, yeah.
Do you want an obituary?
Yes.
What do you want it to say?
I'm not sure, but I will write it.
Need to get around to that. You could be... Could be a bus with your name on it out there. You can't be putting that off.
I know.
What's an example of something that you find to be just like irrelevant? Like for my dad, he said, put down I was president of the ATO fraternity at Emory, and my mother said, no one cares.
Right.
So what should go in about you?
I think what should go in about me is that I am somebody that was successful in creating a business, whatever those businesses or business ends up including, and that I was somebody that really enjoyed helping people and felt very fulfilled helping people. Because I think if you look at all of the things that could be on an obituary, if you listed, you know, the endless, she was on this board, she did this,
committee.
She did that. Yeah, it's all about helping people. And so if you wanted to just sum it up, it would be, she helped a lot of people.
That's neat.
Yeah.
But clearly some of those are more important. Some of those committees or whatever.
Right. Right.
More important than others.
Yeah. And I think the obituary that I write today would definitely be different than an obituary that I would write, down the road. I wrote my dad's obituary and...
Did he get to see it?
Mm-mm. No.
You didn't give him right to edit?
No. And it's interesting because he wrote a lot and maybe we just haven't found it, but I would have... I was a little bit surprised that there wasn't already something started. He wrote his parents' obituaries, and so I was surprised. But maybe that was just his struggle with his diagnosis and accepting that things weren't going well and his, you know, the fact that he wasn't well and didn't have a lot of energy, for a good bit of the time at the end. And so maybe that was it. But it was a completely blank Word document when I started. But writing it from my perspective. I hope I didn't leave anything out, but I summed it up very differently. You know, it didn't read like a resume, like a lot of people's.
They used to say, the joke is, your obit is your resume in past tense.
Yeah, yeah.
Which and
it,
is...
It very much is. But I, you know, in some obituaries that you read, it's, you know, the person, whoever wrote the obituary left out something that was really a big part of that person, or the experience of that person.
It bugs the shit out of me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I call it Mad Libs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Jennifer was born,
yes.
Insert date,
right.
Daughter of, insert people,
right.
Went to insert school, married, insert person, had kids, didn't have kids, served here, served there, had this job,
right.
Or sometimes was a Braves fan.
Right.
Or,
right.
You know, pull for the Tar Heels or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just like, and I'm like, Lord, deliver me from anyone saying, give you the shirt off their back.
Right.
Lit up a room.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just like, I'm going to light you up.
Right.
If I hear that one more time, I'm going to need a story.
Yes, yes. It was, so I taught death and dying.
Where?
At Belmont Abbey. I taught for about 14 years in their adult degree program.
What was your syllabus? What are the best books?
So for Death and Dying, we read, it was a very different class because we didn't have a textbook for that. We read Tuesdays with Maury.
Oh.
And then, I'm going to forget the name of it, but we read the book that was about, oh gosh.
Was it the woman who had been with a bunch of people and said, this is what people really care about when they know they're going to die?
No.
It was the nurse.
Oh, yeah. I know which book you're talking about. No, it was called The Deaths of Nancy Cruzan. And the death is plural because the book, it was actually written by her attorney. And it was a life support case similar to like Terri Schiavo. And he took it all the way to the Supreme Court. And but it says deaths because of how many, you know, essentially different times she had to die, or the family had to push for her to be able to be taken off of life support. And so the fact that they felt like every time they got to the end was another death. That was just a really interesting book. And it went into a lot of detail about, you know, end of life care and what it means, you know, to have artificial hydration and nutrition when you're in a vegetative state. There were lots of activities that went into that class too. We did a cemetery analysis, and it was always fascinating for me to get feedback from people how many people are petrified to go into cemeteries and how uncomfortable that experience is for so many people. And luckily there's a cemetery on campus, and so we would go one night over to the cemetery on campus and walk through, and I would talk to them about the assignment and how to do the assignment, kind of using that cemetery as an example. But we had an obituary assignment, and I only ever had one person that just flat out said, I absolutely refuse to do this. I can't do this at all. But most everyone was like, wow, this is actually going to be helpful, and I've already given copies to my kids, or I've already, you know, this is going to be something I update. But a lot of it was about, you know, don't you want to be the person that summarizes what is important in your life if you had to write a summary?
I do, but I'm stunned by the people who don't.
Right.
And I think that's because of a delusion. And that is, the delusion is that somehow other people are going to get you.
Right.
That they're going to know you better than you.
Right.
And I'm like, well, then you haven't examined your life very much, because you are the only expert in you.
Right. Right.
Nobody else knows you better than you.
Right.
And so you can either tell your story or it's not going to get told. They're going to tell a story about you.
Right.
They're not going to tell your story. Nobody else can tell anyone else's story.
Right.
Because you know how you felt about it.
Right. Exactly.
And you are the only one who can say what it meant to.
Right.
So if we got struck by lightning today, and the only thing that survived is this little piece of digital audio, Jennifer Sockeye. What is your legacy?
I think my legacy is really that I have tried in all the things that I've done to have a life of service and helping people. And I really do. I would hope that family feels that way. I would hope that coworkers and clients and other people that know me, you know, friends in different ways would be able to describe me as somebody who was, you know, generous in spirit and was always there for people. That's what's really important to me.
That's beautiful.
Thanks.
Well, thank you for being the first title sponsor to CLT First.
Thank you. I'm excited about that.
That's a great podcast. Wonderful. And I hope we are able to grow that.
Absolutely.
Because I think it has a good mission. That mm-hmm. is to siphon off a lot of the murder and mayhem and Debbie Downer kind of stuff and really celebrate Charlotte as a really cool place.
Right.
And thank you for doing this, because I could talk to you. This is my jam, and mm-hmm. I could talk to you all day long about this. And I am going to bend your ear.
Okay.
So thanks for making time.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer Sockeye, and thank you for telling us about DNRs, the do not resuscitate reports, the really practical kinds of applications. I've been there, I've lived through it, and I admire the work you do. I admire the service you do. And I particularly want to thank you for sponsoring CLT First on the Queen City Podcast Network, our Monday through Friday daily news program. Thank you, ma'am.
In Her Words is a production of the Queen City Podcast Network in cooperation with Balto Creative Media. Allison Andrews at Andrews Creative, Rachel Clapp Miller, and Roshonda Pratt are developmental producers. Sally Higgins at Higgins & Owens tries to keep us legal. Our music is A Day at the Park by the group Pictures of the Floating World. Your announcer is Catherine Smith. That's me. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and take a moment to rate and review. It really helps others find us. If you love us, go to our Patreon page at patreon.com. Look for Man Listening, one word, no spaces. A small investment makes a big difference in lifting up the voices of women.
A huge shout out and thank you to everyone who has supported this podcast from the very beginning, whether it's at manlistening.com, In Her Words, the podcast, or now my new venture, Voice Locket. Check it out, voicelocket.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you for your support. We believe one voice can change the conversation. Thanks so much.